Morning.
Thank you.
Welcome to Senate Finance. There's a couple of bills that we heard earlier this week that I'd like to get out early this morning. Thank you. It's 9:25 on April the 17th. President's table are Senator Wilkins, Senator Lehman, Senator Ward. I was just here a few minutes ago. Senator Donnelly, Senator Hoffman, Senator Osterman, Senator Green, and myself, Senator Kelly. And let's go ahead with the building fund bill first. Amy, could you come up, and Ramon maybe? No, I don't have that. It's a member of the agricultural program. Thank you. Were there any other questions of the sponsor for the... Oh, Senator Olson has joined us as well, for the record. Were there any other questions of the sponsor or the department on this bill? Okay, hearing none. Senator Osterman?
I just want to make a statement, Mr. Chairman. I expressed my concerns last time we heard this bill about the issue of continuing to move funds off budget, so to speak, into other funds rather than classifying them in my term as general funds. I think it's a poor practice. I'm not going to object to this bill going out of committee because this is a practice that we already have established, but I think it's a poor practice. I think that at some point in time we need to get back to moving this stuff into GF so we actually know what our budget is.
Thank you for your comments, Senator Osterman. Senator Wilkin, can I get a motion, please?
Chair, move to report House Bill 262 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there objections? Hearing none, House Bill 262 has moved from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Thank you. Next, we have the... Which is now in...
We got to introduce a bill that takes fishing game.
Eminent domain. Yes. Bill. Did you briefly go through what was in the CS? Are you prepared to do
sure.
that?
Sure. For the record, Kim Ockmusty in Senator Torgerson's
office.
Speak
a little louder, please.
Sure.
Thank you.
The CS, the newest CS that you have, version F, reinserted what was exactly...
Excuse me, it should be version J.
Version K.
Are you prepared to speak to version J?
Oh,
okay. Give you a brief at ease. Go ahead and take a look. Okay. Okay, we're back on the record. Go ahead.
What this CS does is reinsert what was taken out in Senate Judiciary.
Excuse me. Go ahead.
Reinsert what was taken out in Senate Judiciary. Same content, but Ledge Legal has suggested rearranging the order and the way she expressed it, but it was the exact same content.
So it was essentially the version that we adopted. We voted at the end of that
yes.
committee meeting to adopt the intent, and then Ledge Legal redrafted it somewhat.
Exactly.
With no substantive changes, but technical changes. Okay.
No.
Any questions or comments from the sponsor? Senator Wilkin.
Mr. Chair, move to report Senate Bill 278 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Are there objections? Hearing none, Senate Bill 278 has moved from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. Senator Donnelly has a maintenance of effort resolution, which I think is outstanding, and I think anyone who's ever had the education budget as a subcommittee will probably think it's outstanding as well.
Or Hess.
Yeah, Hess is a good one, that's right.
Sure. Brief and ease.
Yes, brief and ease. Senator Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could we have a brief and ease?
Yes. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, there is a proposed committee substitute. It just puts the words maintenance of effort into the title so that people can understand what it's about. The current title is a little confusing or vague, and so I would move the adoption of the committee substitute, the Cook F version.
The Cook F version has been moved. Are there objections to adopting the F version? Hearing none, that version is before us.
Mr. Chairman, I think all the members of the committee are familiar with this issue. This resolution just asks the federal government to consider a 1 or 2 year moratorium on maintenance efforts requirements so that states can adjust their spending consistent with the current needs and budgetary restraints. If there are any questions about it, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Any questions of the sponsor? I would say that we talked to the congressman about 3 weeks ago, and Senator Donnelly put forward this idea, and I know that the Congress is looking for ways of saving money just like anyone else is. And he certainly thought it was a great idea, and it has not come before either body as far as he knows. And it's probably a debate worth starting, and I'm sure it won't come about for a few years, but nonetheless, it allows the states to establish a new level of maintenance of effort so that you're not constantly held to whatever may have happened in the past. If you have to find ways to save, you can do that without losing a lot of federal funds. And what this does is it gives a moratorium on the maintenance of effort requirements, or what it does is it asks for the Congress to come up with a way to have a moratorium on these maintenance of effort provisions. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to know, why was the term of 2 years used as opposed to something longer or even shorter?
Senator Donnelly?
You know, right now 43 states have budget shortfalls. It's tough all over the country. And I understand why Congress uses maintenance of efforts requirements. The problem is, once they're there, they're locked in forever. And I thought it'd be reasonable to give the states just a window of opportunity to readjust their budgets. And you know, not necessarily do away with maintenance of effort, you know, because the key to the feds is that you're not taking federal funds and replacing state funds, is they want you to keep moving, you know, towards whatever program goal they want, and that's reasonable. But it also seems reasonable to allow the states an opportunity to adjust once in a while based on all kinds of factors that occur.
Okay. Mr. Norland, did you want to testify?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Nordland, Director of the Division of Public Assistance, and I just wanted to make a couple comments, perhaps, and answer any questions that the committee members might have about maintenance of effort. I think that Senator Donnelly probably was motivated mostly by the TANF program, which has the largest maintenance of effort requirement of the for programs we were able to identify that have such a provision. The other ones, incidentally, are the SAMHSA block grant, the maternal child health block grant, as well as the infant learning program block grants. And I really don't have a lot of information on those, but I can tell you about the TANF block grant. The maintenance effort was put into place, and Senator Donnelly, I appreciate the fact that you recognize, you know, why maintenance of effort provisions are in the law. But under the former AFDC program, which is a predecessor before welfare reform to the TANF block grant, that program was funded 50% state funding, 50% federal funding. When it became a block grant, there was a lot of debate about what should be the proper role of states in helping to finance that program. And there was a concern that the states would defund the program and create what was known as a race to the bottom, to be the state to have the lowest welfare benefits and therefore save state funding in that fashion. So what Congress did is put in place a maintenance of effort that requires states to participate at least 80% of the funding that was spent in 1994, which is incidentally the same year that the block grant level is based upon. So in Alaska, we have, for the TANF program, gone down to that 80% level. I also might point out that there is some flexibility under the TANF program that has allowed the legislature to realize general fund savings by using federal TANF dollars to supplant primarily childcare dollars, general funded childcare dollars. And so if you take the combination of the fact that we've gone down from 100% maintenance of effort to 80%, the supplantation of dollars that have gone into childcare, plus other savings associated with welfare reform, we've realized about $50 million of savings through the program. So But we maintain that it's still important that Congress keep the maintenance of effort provision in place. I would point out that for the TANF program is being reauthorized by Congress this year, and in proposals by Congress and proposals by President Bush, nobody is talking about getting rid of the maintenance of effort. So certainly you can express your opinion with this resolution, but I'm not sure how much success you're going to have with the Congress.
Well, Mr. Nordlund, I think that was the point of what I was saying earlier on, was that no one is talking about revising the maintenance of effort. And it was just interesting to see the reaction of one congressman when he heard the idea for the first time, and that was from Senator Donnelly, who had recommended to it. And I know exactly where the genesis of this was. When I was in the House, Senator Donnelly and I both had the education budget. He had it in the Senate, and I had it in the House, and we had a couple of meetings, and we just decided there's nothing we can do. We're trapped by this maintenance of effort thing. And Senator Donnelly came up with the idea of readjusting it. And they wouldn't let us do it. And then as the idea has grown, he's decided to send along a resolution, because you're right, no one's talking about it. But I tell you what, I think there will be some people that are talking about it in the next few years. Senator Donnelly?
Boy, if ever there was a gap in philosophy between the Knowles administration and fiscal discipline, boy, it just emerged just now, didn't it, Jim? I mean, you don't even want to have states the option to consider readjusting their budgets. You know, states all over America, 43 states are in a budget situation. And you don't even want to let the state governments make their own decision, the governments that's closer to the people than the federal governments. You'd rather rely on a federal government to dictate spending levels than even allow us to make decisions based on the situations of our individual states. I mean, philosophically, I'm just stunned that you are so far radical left and so far out there that you wouldn't even allow the option, the states, to make their own decisions. And given, you know, where our situation was created, you know, starting back in the 80s and maybe the 70s, when there was lots of money around, when there was oil prices were expected to go to $60 a barrel, to say that we shouldn't now even have the option to consider making some reasonable adjustments based on our conditions today is just stunning to me. What a philosophical gap. I never knew it was that dramatic, the gap between the Knowles administration being so entrenched in big government and more spending, that I just never realized it was that big a gap between us and the philosophy of just allowing the option to consider trying to control government growth and to readjust based on need, rather than some status quo that developed 10 or 20 years ago. I'm just stunned.
Thanks, Senator. Any other questions of the testifier? Thank you, Mr. Nordlund. Questions or comments about the bill? Hearing none, Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, we've adopted the CS. It just was a title change. I'd move Senate Joint Resolution 43, the committee substitute from committee with individual recommendations.
Are there objections? Hearing none, Senate Joint Resolution 43 has been moved from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal notes. We're going to have to bring that eminent domain bill back up. There was apparently a technical problem with it that we can fix rather quickly. I'm going to take a brief of these to figure out what that was. So. Good morning, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for taking House Bill 4 up again. Mr. Chairman, we have an e-version CS if the committee wishes to take that up, which included the all the amendments that were on the table at our last meeting, but without debate. There are some, I've got some concerns about some of the amendments that would be in version E, but I believe we need to adopt that.
You want to go ahead and run through those concerns?
What we did was changed some of the definition and parameters of the court order treatment programs, and then we also made some changes in the amount of fines and the amount of mandatory minimum sentences for both the DUI and the failure to consent. And there was a question I had brought before the committee about whether we wanted to have a 50 or 75% reduction in the fine. And the CS has a 75% reduction, and I have an amendment to correct that, Mr. Chairman. Because the department, and I think I believe, and that's something I wanted to have the committee discuss this a little bit about the policy call on that. We just went ahead and adopted the 75% reduction, which I think we should back up to the 50%. But
could you direct me that on which page it is?
That's on starts on page 21, line 21, actually, on the E version.
21, did you say?
Yeah. Yes. Awesome. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Line 20.
Page 19. And line 19 on page 21 in the E version.
We're working on the E version, is that correct?
E.
We haven't adopted it yet, but he was pointing out some of the concerns
he
had.
Yeah, it's actually 18. It's on the subsection Q there, which says the court determines the person has successfully completed a quarter of a treatment program, the court may suspend up to 75%. We want to have the amendment to change that to a portion of the mandatory minimum sentence and up to 50% of the minimum fines. This is for individuals that had two or more been in a treatment program, that further allows two or more times. But that's the issue there. The policy deserves some debate in committee, but and my recommendation is to default to the portion and believing in 75% of the sentence and adding portion and then changing 75% of the fine to 50%. But that's an amendment E4 that we have, Mr. Chairman. If I could go on, unless you want to discuss that now.
Go ahead.
Additionally, Mr. Chairman, there was added an amendment by Senator Donnelly on page 6 of the E-version, which I call the Scarlet Letter provision. This adds a person convicted more than once to their DUI, a distinguishing mark on the face of their driver's license. And Mr. Chairman, this is an amendment that was on the table that was not discussed by the committee, in which I oppose. Okay. And that's on, like I say, page 6, line 5, section 10. And moving on, Mr. Chairman, it also eliminates the limited license provisions that we had in the M version, which were opposed by the Department of Law, and I agree with that position.
Which page is that?
Which one?
Well, the one you're talking about. What page was it on?
It's
not in the M version.
It's not in the E version.
Okay.
Deleted it.
Okay.
It was in the
Go ahead and describe it again. I'm sorry.
Also, Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly had a provision which I do support.
Excuse me, Representative Roper, could you go back to that portion you had just said? I think I got everybody sidetracked there. Could you restate that?
The M version had a provision to grant a limited license. The current law is only whatever the length of suspension is. It's only the last 60 days. The Department of Law, the administration, I tend to agree we would like to keep that. We had some testimony that the therapeutic court wanted to have some liberality in granting work licenses, but we had a kind of a hue and cry on that, so we're going to recede from that, and that's what the deletions from the E version are, so they're not in the E version. Now, Senator Donnelly provided an amendment on the table that provided that an offender must maintain proof of financial responsibility and be mandated into the SR22 insurance program. I support that. And that is, line 26 through page 13, line 3. New section 20 regarding that. That's Senator Donnelly's amendment, and I approve of that one.
And, Mr. Chairman...
Senator Brookberg, could you speak a little louder, please? The acoustics in this room are horrible. If you could speak a little louder.
Yes, sir. And then, finally, Mr. Chairman, on page 34, lines 18 through 30, in new section 36, this provides for a pilot program for the Department of Corrections to use a drug or a combination of drugs, much like naltrexone in the therapeutic courts, in the Department of Corrections. It's a pilot program that came to $100,000, and it was in large part because the way I believe the fiscal note should be handled, used $100,000 that's generated by the revenue in the bill. And just to repeat to the committee, it's my intention that with the adjustments to the Public Defender and Department of Law's request of the fiscal notes, that this bill is basically a zero note, notwithstanding the fact that there are substantial fines available. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that is the changes to the e-version.
Go ahead, Senator Green.
Would you go back and show me the reference to the SR-22?
Maybe Senator Green, it's page 12, line 26.
This is something we had a bit of discussion on in caucus last night.
Yesterday, I was all gone.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease and go ahead and read over that if you want.
I was just explaining the changes that currently under the Alaska Mandatory Auto Insurance Act, you're not required to, the insurance companies are not required to notify the state if you fail to maintain your insurance. But for some people who have been in accidents and not had insurance, or people who have DWIs, we require them to obtain what's called SR-22, and I don't know exactly why. It's some sort of form or notice.
Isn't SR-22 just a high-risk pool?
No, it's more than that. It actually requires insurance companies that if you fail to keep your insurance active, to notify the state that you've canceled your insurance. Well, that's the way mandatory insurance is in a lot of states, for everybody. But here in Alaska, we just require it of certain high-risk individuals. For short periods of time, people who have been in accidents and were caught without insurance, people who were cited for failure to maintain insurance, people who commit DWI. So they go into a type of insurance called SR-22 where the state gets notice if they don't maintain their insurance. And what this provision says is that for repeat offenders, the period of time you have to maintain that SR-22 class insurance is longer based on how many offenses you've committed. So that if you're a five-time DWI driver, we're going to make you have the SR-22 insurance, so the state will get notified if you ever fail to keep insurance on your car. And I think that's real reasonable because many states, everybody has to do that. Everybody's in an SR-22 class. I mean, anytime anybody cancels their insurance in North Carolina or some other states that have strict mandatory auto insurance, the insurance companies are required to notify the state, and they go through that process. In Alaska, we only do it for high-risk individuals, people who have already been caught breaking the law. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for people who have a history of drunk driving that we just make them provide that extra level of insurance notification so that if they do fail to maintain their insurance as required by law, the state would know about it.
Okay. I have two questions. For one thing, when we talk about, correct me if I'm wrong, about auto insurance, we insure the automobile.
That's correct.
Okay. So this person, there's nothing, this doesn't address this person driving another car.
Nope.
Okay. Early on, probably 6, maybe 7 years ago, when this was still in the Department of Public Safety, I can recall having people contact me and say there's no follow-up to the current law on people who are either, I don't know if it was found driving without insurance, without proof or whatever. And at that time, it was not being followed up. And upon inquiry, am I talking about something else?
Well, the current Fiscal Responsibility Act, Financial Responsibility Act and mandatory auto insurance resulted in something like 5,000 suspensions of licenses last year. So I don't believe these people that are alleging there's no follow-up are accurate. I got the numbers just recently from DMV, just last week, and you know, I can go to the office and show you. But there's thousands of suspensions every year for people who fail to maintain their insurance under SR 22 and who failed to show proof of insurance after they were in an accident or received a traffic citation.
Well, that's fine, because and perhaps once...
And there's another category, too, by the way. It's people who fail to pay judgments from... they're in an accident, they don't have insurance, they fail to pay the judgment, they suspend their licenses also.
Do you agree?
And that may have come about when it changed to admin, when DMV switched over, because I know public safety had said it was very difficult for them to find this as a high priority when other things were going on. And so maybe that was a good thing that came with the change. I don't know. And it may have been another topic going on. The ability to disobey and to not pay attention to the current law is possible.
Not the SR 22 portion.
Not the SR 22.
Because, of course, once somebody has
gotten into that pool,
and they're required by law to have an SR 22, when they go and get their license to register a vehicle, when they register a vehicle, they're in the computer system as having to have SR 22. They have to show proof of insurance at the time they register a vehicle. That is a, so they go to a little more expensive insurance pool for that because the insurance company has this extra paperwork, so they charge them more. And you know they're a high risk too because they've had a DWI or some other problem in the past. So the insurance company gives them proof of insurance. They have to show that when they register. And then the other thing about it is that in this class of insurance, which they're required to maintain for a certain number of years, I don't know if it's 1, 2, or 3 for first offense, something like that, if they fail to maintain their insurance, the insurance company notifies the DMV that they failed to maintain their insurance, which is a violation of the law, right? Because they're required to maintain insurance, you know. And then the DMV will, you know, pull their license if they don't comply.
They're agreed.
Can I not own a driver's license and not own a car?
Oh, sure.
Well, I think I have it figured out. I mean, I just don't want people to think that this is going to be an effective tool for getting at what you're trying to get at.
Well,
because this it solves the problem for the person who's had the violation, who's had the citation, and has gone to buy a car to get a driver's license. And that's all.
That's
it
right.
It does not address anyone else. And I can guarantee, I would assume that most of these people are not going to be out buying cars. So don't let this be this is going to fix very many people.
Well, I think it's going to fix a lot of people, because I think a lot of people that have previous DWIs, they do go out and buy cars and own vehicles. So there are some, of course, that aren't going to, and are going to drive without a license, and are going to drive somebody else's vehicle. But still, for those who do buy vehicles, this is the best, easiest, it's a no-cost provision, zero cost to the state.
To the state?
Yeah.
Just have one other question.
Agreed.
On page 19, and I perhaps missed the discussion on line 29, shall permanently revoke the person's driver's license. And that's like permanent forever, line 29.
Mr. Chairman, Janet Seitz, Representative Rookberg's office. Hi. Yes. That's in the felonies, the fine, and then permanently revoke the driver's license. But there's a subject to restoration of the license under P of this section. So then you have to go over to page 21, line 12. On request, the department shall review a driver's license revocation and may restore the driver's license if it's been revoked for at least 10 years and the person has not been convicted of a criminal offense since the license was revoked, and the person provides proof of financial responsibility.
And the insertion of the word permanently was recommended there? It is not permanently revoked. It's just revoked.
It's permanently with an appeals
process.
It's also revoked with an appeal process. Mr. Chairman?
I'm not sure that's
permanently. Permanently implies something that I don't know that we need to imply. I mean, I'm not sure what the, I mean, some lawyer may have said this was the way to do it, but if you're revoking it, it's revoked.
But I think in it says permanently subject to.
Revoke it subject to. Unless there's a different re-entry after a permanent revocation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Green, yes, there is, because the person has to request the department to review if their license has been permanently revoked. It's not an automatic review. It's an action of the individual.
Senator Green.
If my license has been revoked, do I not have to have an appeal or hearing or address it with someone?
If it's been revoked, there's a process by which it comes back to you automatically, isn't it, over a period of time?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, depending on the length of revocation that the court may have ordered or that the statutes require.
Sure, this is not a permanent revocation.
Offer the amendment.
It's permanent. It's permanent subject to. I mean, it is what it says it is in the same line. It says permanent subject to.
It's the meat of the matter.
It might be a distinction without a terrible amount of difference there. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 21, where you are talking about one of the conditions for reinstatement of the driver's license, you talk about the proof of financial responsibility.
Senator Olson, the noise in this room drives me nuts. What page?
Page 21.
Oh, same one, okay.
Under line 3, section 33, where it says the reinstatement has to do with the reinstatement of the driver's license, and you talk about the proof of financial responsibility. I guess what's the thinking there? Obviously, you don't have to be a millionaire, but it's what documentation are you thinking?
Mr. Chairman, for anybody to have their driver's license, they have to show proof of financial responsibility. Every citizen of the state does, either in the form of insurance and or a bond or a signature right now. Senator Donnelly and I are trying to change that, but everybody has to have proof of financial responsibility.
So I think I can help a little bit here.
Senator Olson, you had a...
So when I go in to get a driver's license, I've got to show something I never showed anything.
Senator,
I got a driver's license.
Now you sign.
When you go in to register your motor vehicle, there's a little oath you take. And there's conditions 1, 2, and 3, and they require that you maintain insurance or proof of financial responsibility while you own that vehicle. And the reason that the magic words here are financial responsibility, because they can be met different ways. It can be met with insurance, or it can be met with a certificate of self-insurance from the Department of Administration. And that requirement is you go to the Department of Administration, you show you have, I think it's $100,000 or $125,000 in assets available to pay judgments for damages you may do while you're driving, then you can get a certificate. So when they refer to proof of financial responsibility, they mean one of those two things.
But that has to do with the driver's license, and you're talking about vehicle registration, two different issues.
Yeah, but when you reinstate your license, they're going to make you do that also.
I see.
If you've been had your license suspended.
Okay.
Representative Roper, there were, let's go back to the, I think the first issue you brought up was page 21, line 21.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And you wanted to just remove that technical amendment to just,
Well, I have provided, if the committee wanted to adopt the E-version CS, I have an amendment E-4 that accomplishes that. As well as, Mr. Chairman, it also provides on, we heard some testimony at the last hearing about the disposal of forfeited vehicles. When the Department of Public Safety was talking about flying them in from Dillingham or something. So we added that in this E.4 amendment, the ability in statute to allow them to transfer it to a charitable organization. That's at the bottom of the second page of E.4.
Okay.
And what E.4 does, it deletes the 75% of the sentence. And then goes to a portion of the sentence, and then it deletes the 75% of the minimum fine and goes back up to 50% of the minimum fine. But this is only if a person has completed their court-ordered treatment program. This gives some flexibility to the courts to give a carrot to those people that enter in these treatment programs.
I'm going to take a break at ease.
$3 for 6 months.
We can adopt the e-version CS, then we can pick up the amendment.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to go is to adopt e-version.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Donnelly?
I'd move the adoption of the e-Ford version 410.02 for discussion purposes and additional amendment.
Are there objections? The e-version has been adopted. Senator Wilken, do you have the first amendment?
Chairman, I move amendment number 15.
No, that's not E.
Yes. It is number 15. But
E4, like number 15.
It sounds like an E4.
Yeah. Oh, my. 15. Where is 15? Oh.
Mr. Chairman?
This is
speaking to the amendment, I just had a discussion with Department of Law regarding line 5 through 7 and 11
of the amendment 5 through 7 and 10 and 11. Okay.
I think I'm fine on the rest of the amendment, but I would like to have some committee discussion on that policy call that's contained there. In discussing with the Department of Law, their intent, they said to me, was to actually which I don't understand why they don't like up to 75%. Maybe they should come forward and explain.
Ms. Carpinetti, did you want to come forward and explain?
Too much flexibility.
And just to clarify my remarks, I understand that 10 and 11 just deal with the monetary fine. Is that correct? So that's fine with us, I think.
I'm sorry, 10 and 11?
Lines 10 and 11 of amendment number 15.
Oh, I haven't seen the amendment.
Go ahead and have a brief at ease.
Focus my remarks. I'm just wanted a discussion of 6 and 7 of the two is what I'm interested in.
Ms. Carpinetti?
Well, the Department of Law's position is that it's a good thing for, and it's a deterrent for people to serve some jail time. And maybe a portion is not the best answer because it does give discretion to suspend the mandatory sentence for up to 99%. Perhaps the 75% is better. Our concern was not was to make sure that people who are convicted of DWI do spend some time incarcerated as a deterrent.
Representative Roper, do you have a comment on that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what we wanted to do here now, just to remind our members of the committee, this is only for those offenders that are in a treatment program at the district court level, like a wellness court type setting. So the theory here, this is not generally applicable, but it could be by a judge who has somebody that's committed to a treatment program. And this is intended to be the carrot. So we want to give the judge some flexibility in assigning how much time is going to be hard time and how much time and the amount of the fine. We want to give the judge some flexibility. The question, policy question, Mr. Chairman, is how much is it should be 75% or a portion, which could be more than 75% or less than 75%. That's why the recommendation from the Department of Law when we came up with the amendment was to go with a portion that maximizes the flexibility. On the other hand, I think we tend to think of the Department of Law as soft on crime. They're not. The judges may be soft on crime. That's the concern of the legislature.
Well, I think even if you look at it, our the criminal courts, we probably have very little argument with the criminal courts. Our argument are with the more of the social courts.
No, that's also true. Basically, with the criminal side, Mr. Chairman, in terms of what they do in terms of mandatory minimums, that's why we raised them up here initially in the bill, but because of the fiscal notes, we had to delete them. But that, and that's because of what happens in the real world out there. Nevertheless, I commend it to the committee as to the amount of flexibility. Should we have a minimum floor of 75% or a portion? I can live with either one, but not 50%.
My preference is, go ahead, Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And because it could lead to an amendment to the amendment, I need to ask at this time, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I do not have it in my packet, the requested legal opinion as to whether or not it would be constitutional for people that receive DWIs or multiple DWIs, whether or not they can be discriminated against and gone to 0.04. If maybe you can make copies of that if you have a legal opinion.
I do.
Right. Yes, and the answer is yes, Senator Wood.
The answer is yes, you can?
Yeah.
Okay, well, with that, I certainly at least want to be able to discuss that, and this is probably the area that it should go in, but I won't object to this amendment, but this is the very part of it, the therapeutic report, that it needs to be in for that extra tool. Because, Mr. Chairman, it's kind of silly to tell somebody they can't drink for 18 months, and then 18 months in one day, you say you now can have a drink.
We have an amendment before us, and we have an amendment to the amendment before us, Senator Donnelly.
Towards that issue, I think I'm more supportive of the existing language of up to 75%, but it is kind of mitigated, taking the other side of the argument here, by the fact that now the bill only allows that to happen twice, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me just put something on the table here. I move an amendment to the amendment to delete lines 5, 6, and 7. And I think reasonable minds can reasonably disagree on this. People just put the proposition before us and we can vote it up or down.
I'm going to speak against it. I think I'm going to prefer that we just have that the portion is in there. Senator Hoffman and then, Representative Roper, do you want
to go on the question? For the amendment to the amendment to be complete, it needs to include page 2, line 1 through 3 also.
Page what?
Page 2, lines 1 through 3.
Second 2.
Page. 2.4 and number 15.
Okay. That's fine. The sponsor says that's a technical.
I think they achieve somewhat the same thing, and I think there may be some instances out there where you'd run up against this number and you'd wish you wished you hadn't. And I think a portion accomplishes that to leave it the amendment as it is. Senator Hoffman?
I think Dave's amendment is a good one.
Excuse me?
I think Dave's amendment is a good one.
Okay. Rob, on the amendment to the amendment, are there any other questions or comments?
Senator Osterman?
Yes.
Senator
yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ward?
Yes.
Senator Wilson?
No.
Senator Donnelly?
Yes.
Senator Kelly?
No.
7, 3, 2, 8.
On the amendment, are there any further questions or comments? Any objection? Hearing none, amendment number 15 has been adopted. Senator Wilkin, there are other amendments here with your name on it. They are earlier amendments. Are you withdrawing those?
14.
Chairman, I move amendment number 14.
would amendment number 14 do?
Representative Rothberg, could you briefly explain amendment 14?
E1.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this is the one we adopted the committee substitute last week. At the request of the chair, we picked up all the amendments that were on the table, without discussion. And what this does is this deletes the amendment that was offered by Senator Donnelly on page 6, lines 5 through 22. And what this is, Mr. Chairman, is what I call the Scarlet Letter Amendment, which adds to an individual's driver's license a mark indicating that he's been convicted more than once for the DUI offense. And I submit, Mr. Chairman, that I find this very problematic. We haven't had really a discussion in any of the committees, although early on when we first started this bill with the Anchorage DUI Task Force, this was one of the many suggestions that were considered by the task force and further in committee hearings over 2 years ago and rejected. It was rejected, Mr. Chairman, because it really doesn't do anything. The way that the amendment is included in the CS right now, it merely puts a mark on the license. But we're branding somebody, so therefore, whenever anybody went out in public, they'd have to show this at the airport, for example, when you're checking into your airplane. Now, what does that have to do? What I really see this as is an attempt to put some additional liability on licensees in the state of Alaska. I don't think that's exactly the right policy direction we should go. Whereas this amendment doesn't now, it could very easily, by a simple amendment, put liability on those licensees to check the driver's license of a patron, and then to do what, Mr. Chairman?
Any alcohol?
Well, that's prohibition. I think it's unconstitutional on equal protection grounds. And it doesn't cover a lot of other offenses either. Plus, Mr. Chairman, the liquor industry is the most highly regulated industry in this state. And I think that what we want to do is keep patrons in licensed premises where they can be controlled, where they can't be served if they're intoxicated. We have the TAMS training standards that are put forward by servers in this state. And they're trained now not to serve people who are intoxicated. But I'm not sure that this doesn't lead up to something that says you can't even be served in here. And if you did that, I think we're really running the risk of having a challenge on constitutional grounds. It's to say nothing of turning the licensees into like alcohol cops and sorting people out and discriminating against certain people.
And when you say licensees, you mean the establishments.
Right. Plus, Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned, those places generally have dram shop insurance. They have provisions if somebody leaves there, that so people can be protected. Because what's going to happen, I suspect if this were to be passed, that we would help generate more after-hours nightclubs and bars and gambling dens in the state of Alaska. It's a significant problem already in the Anchorage area. But if this happened, I think that could very well happen. It's a real big problem in Anchorage. So, I don't understand what this is doing. It's really a toothless tiger right now, but I can see downstream where it would be shifting the liability onto licensees. And I'm not sure that's the right way we want to.
Well, if the bartenders don't currently check everyone's license when they come in, the bartenders don't check everyone's license when they come in. If they don't do that, then the mark on the license for anybody that doesn't look underage. I mean, the reason you would probably check someone's license is to see if they're underage, correct?
That's correct. And this way we have to check everybody's license. Yeah. If there was a subsequent prohibition on either being in an establishment or I don't know what the pain is here.
And so if you were an establishment owner and someone got into an accident from your bar, the claim could be made that you should have checked their license. And if I go into an establishment to have a drink or something, I don't think I should have to show a license other than the fact that I look so young.
This would require you to ask your grandma in a restaurant that she wanted a glass of wine or Sherry with her meal, that you'd have to card her.
I think with the
10% discount because you're
one of the fears that I have is that, you know, it seems it's already happening, but before long the entire world is going to be run by lawyers and risk managers. and this thing says to me that everybody's going to be checked every time, just in case. You know, if you go in, as you said, for a glass of wine, some risk manager will have told the owner of the establishment, everybody's got to be checked every single time, or else you could be liable. And then we're going to find, I just don't want to live in a place where I go and want a glass of wine, and I got to show somebody my papers and to see if my papers are in order. Senator Osterman.
Yeah, bold, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked me this morning about this particular issue, and I had to go back and look at it again. I disagree with you. I think that when people go out and abuse alcohol to the extent that they're killing people, that those people should have some criteria placed upon their ability to go in and get booze, drive, and kill people again. And I don't know of any other way of doing it. As a matter of fact, I don't know if this doesn't even go far enough. I don't know whether we shouldn't even include within this bill the actual statute that says that everybody shall show their driver's license when they go in to get alcohol, whether it be a liquor store or whether it be a bar. I realize that it appears to infringe upon some of our rights, but at the same point in time, it also may be protecting our rights, protecting our lives. And so when we have an issue such as alcohol, which is basically the biggest abuse problem we have in this state, then maybe we do need to step forward and address some of these issues head on. So I think I am opposed to this amendment to take that part out. I think it ought to be even a little bit stronger.
You, Senator Osterman, as you were saying that, I was thinking of analogies, and it is inarguable that every serial killer is involved in pornography. By your logic there, to prevent serial killers, we should have people showing papers essentially to justify buying a magazine or something like that. I don't think the Supreme Court would back that up at all, particularly given what they just did the other day. But I think that it really does, it end up going to Bill of Rights kinds of issues that Americans don't have to show their papers to engage in legal activities. And I think what is ultimately going to happen is either this will be thrown out because eventually someone's going to sue and say, no, I'm engaging in legal activity, I'm 21 years old and I want to have a beer, I don't have to prove to anyone that I'm responsible or not. I am responsible. And I just don't think it'll hold up under the court. Second of all, we're going to have to probably go through a period of time with the risk managers who are essentially in control, unfortunately, of so many businesses, that's exactly what's going to happen. You want to have a beer, you're 39 years old, and you're going to have to show papers. I just don't, that doesn't, it sounds very unconstitutional and certainly un-American to me.
I tend to disagree with you because I think that we have to step forward at some point in time and address the issue of abuse. And when we have alcohol abuse in this state, to the extent that we have it, then at some point in time you do have to step forward and say, it may not be fair to everybody, but at least it might save a few lives.
Well, a lot of people say we have to control guns too in order to stop crime. And I certainly don't want to start going down that road. Senator Donnelly?
Mr. Chairman, well, there's a big difference between abuse and just use. And most of the arguments the sponsor made here really regarding something additional to what's here before us right now, another step that this doesn't do. And this shifting liability argument, I'd like to focus on what the provision actually does, not what some future provision might do, right? First of all. And second, the constitutional boogeyman argument can be made almost anything we do here any day of the week. But the fact is, equal protection does not require government to treat everybody equally. if there's a rational basis test involved, and if the government is reasonably discriminating based on good public policy and public safety, you don't have to treat everybody exactly the same. And your example of gun ownership is a perfect example of that. Unlike alcohol, the right to own guns has a specific constitutional protection, and yet the courts allow us to deny gun ownership to people who have committed felonies. And for that matter, we're in a domestic violence situation. So there's a rational basis there. It's appropriate. And I think that kind of analysis also would easily and appropriately apply to somebody who's abused alcohol. I'm not talking about, and it makes sense, because why should the average citizen who's not abusing alcohol but just using it, and not abusing it, why should we legislate to the lowest common denominator? Why should we not target the abusers? And just as we have prescription drugs, we don't allow everybody to use any drug. I mean, it's not an illegal drug. Insulin and other drugs that people need, we don't make those illegal. If you have a prescription, you can use them. And this is a very similar type thing, I believe, in trying to identify those people who are already proven more than once that they're willing to break the laws and abuse alcohol and endanger other people in society, and to try to target that sector so that the people who don't have that problem, haven't committed those problems, can retain their freedoms. So that's the way I look at this issue. It's not so much Big Brother coming in on everybody. It's actually being more selective in the process for public safety purposes and maintaining the rights of as many people as possible and keeping government out of that. I mean, because the other argument is what the failed prohibition example, where we banned it completely. And obviously, a lot of people, it just wasn't necessary to ban their consumption of alcohol because they weren't a problem to society. But and that was a sweeping change to try to get at what this is a much more targeted effort to maintain the general freedom while trying to address the problem, just as we do with gun ownership and use of prescription drugs.
But I guess I don't see what use it is. If you have this person that has a mark on their license and you're trying to prevent them from drinking alcohol, they're not going to walk into an establishment and say, I have a mark on my driver's license. They're going to go in just like everybody else, and they're going to order a beer, just like I'm going to go in and order a beer. For it to be useful, they have to ask me for my license to get a beer. Now, they're not going to do that, and if they don't, I think that brings up Representative Roper's concern about liability. Or they're going to do that, and then I'm in the situation, as is everyone at this table, of having to, to show documentation so that you can engage in illegal activity. If that's the purpose, then I don't think it's achieved without an encroachment on my rights. If that isn't the purpose, then the other thing that it serves is a stigmatization. When you go to the airport to show your ticket, there's the mark. When you go to cash a check, there's the mark. On and on and on. Why are we going to say that this crime should have a mark any more than domestic abuse, murder, armed robbery? I mean, do we then put marks on everyone's license? Because the intended effect, I don't think you get anything out of it, because either the establishments don't use it and then it has no effect, or they do use it and encroaches on my rights. The secondary thing is that you've stigmatized this person for a specific crime. Point is, if you're going to stigmatize them for committing a crime, there's a whole list of crimes that we can put on that license. I don't think we want to go there. I think it and you were being facetious, Representative Roper, when you said yavol, but that is the image that it brings up to me, that we're going to begin to decide what crimes go on the license. I don't think we need to go there. So, Senator Olson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Certainly the debate can go on and on about what we're going to do and how we can try and rectify the situation. But having, from my experience, treated multiple people in the emergency room that have come in because of people that have abused the privilege of driving while intoxicated, many of which are innocent people that were either bystanders on the street or in other vehicles. Any type of action that deters a drunk driving situation, I am pretty much in favor of. And I think if we are stigmatizing people, that's exactly what we want to do, to try and deter those people that are potentially going to be abusing the privilege of having a driver's license. Thank you.
Senator Olson, I know you wouldn't support this, but you're using the logic that the anti-gun groups use, and that is, we've got to do something. And I know you don't, or I don't think you support, you know, radical gun control, and I'm not trying to make that case, but I think you're going down that same path there, and that is, we've got a problem. The first thing we need to do is go to the Bill of Rights and start changing the way Americans live, rather than going to the problem itself. Senator Wilkin, did you have your hand up?
I only wanted to say, if I thought for the moment that a scarlet letter on my driver's license was going to keep me from abusing alcohol, then I'd support this. But the fact of the matter is, this bill's loaded with punishment, and the intent of the whole bill is to rehabilitate. A scarlet letter on the driver's license for the person that had a DWI today and another one 8 years from now means nothing in either towards punishment to that person nor to rehab that person. That's why this amendment is correct. The scarlet letter does nothing to add to this bill. It only heaps punishment that is above and beyond the intent of the legislation.
Okay, so the Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, I agree with the analysis of Senator Wilkin. To me, this bill is about punishment, rehabilitation, and making a statement. But I just want you to know this provision is a deal breaker, and I do believe the Assistant Attorney General might have a couple other comments on it.
Okay, I'm just taking a brief at ease. Senator Donnelly?
Only Rhodes, the Department of Law had some good technical suggestions, and I'd be happy to incorporate those, but I think that, you know, the question really here is a philosophical one, and I think there's two good sides to this argument. Maybe we just go ahead, vote this up or down, and if it happened to pass, then I could take work with the Department of Law and do the technical little things that, you know, I got the feeling there's probably, you know, not adequate support here to pass, and that would save us a lot of time. But if it did happen to pass, or stay in the bill, I should say, then I would commit to work with the department and do any of the technical things. The DMV folks are concerned, and I just probably could articulate those, that there's other types of IDs that are available to people, so they could avoid this if they got like a state ID or something. But we could fix that as technical, but we couldn't fix the idea of them using a military ID or some third-party ID. So those would be still available to people out there. Additionally, it would need to probably be revamped a little bit so that it take into account people who lost their licenses for refusing to take the breathalyzer. And that I would consider that just a technical. But, you know, I think it's more or less a philosophical discussion we're having now, and then, you know, that would just be a suggestion.
Is there any other questions? Senator Osterman?
You know, the scarlet letter syndrome, there's other ways of doing this. I mean, it could have a chip in it, and it could have the scanning machines and the devices that actually do these things. I don't think it would necessarily have to be tied to the scarlet letter concept of other people having their own license if we really wanted to address the issue.
Senator Ward?
Mr. Chairman, like Senator Olson, I certainly am probably one of those that think that there are some things and extremes that need to be done to those people that are abusing alcohol, not to the general public. I'm not going to support Senator Donnelly's amendment because I don't think that just putting a mark on it does anything. if in fact it was related to a 0.04, which I now see is legal, and I didn't know until this morning whether it was or not, or until just a few minutes ago. Then, as being a condition or release, and I don't, you know, and I know there's some disagreement whether you should give people a one chance or two chances to DWI or three or four. You know, my tolerance level is a lot less than most people's, and I've discussed with the senator from the North Slope about it, so I'm going to oppose this just because it doesn't do anything. And in fact, if it does do 0.04, and I'm going to work with Senator Donnelly on this to try to do something like that, because and whatever your tolerance level is, committee, mine is after one. I think you shouldn't be able to drink again. But if you think that people should have three before they can't have a drink again, then fine. I don't agree with that. But right now, just putting a stamp on there, I don't think does it.
Senator Ward, and for the committee's member, because we got a little turned around on Senator Donnelly's amendment. Actually, this isn't Senator Donnelly's amendment. If you were against Senator Donnelly's proposition, you would vote for the amendment,
right,
because
right.
Representative Roper wants to take it. So, Senator Olson?
That was a question I had. Voting for the amendment extinguishes the scarlet letter situation. Okay, that was my only question.
Are any other questions or comments from the committee? The amendment is, Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Osterman had suggested earlier a way to toughen it up, and I just suggest that instead of deleting all material, one way to toughen it up would be just delete the last three words. I want to see how long it took for people there.
At last, the Senate speaks again.
The amendment has been moved. It's on the table. Are there objections to the amendment?
Yes.
Yes, there are. Okay. Robin, go ahead.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Lehman?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Ward?
Yes.
Senator Wilton?
Yes.
Senator Osterman?
No.
Senator Donnelly?
No.
Senator Pettit?
Yes.
6 May, 2 May. Excuse me, 3 May.
The amendment has passed. Senator Wilton, did you want to offer amendment number 13?
Mr. Chairman, that's Senator Donnelly's, and I'll pass that to him.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Right.
Number 13, I think it's.
The long one.
Just pitch it.
This,
he's going to withdraw
simple
it.
Technical amendment.
It's a technical amendment.
Yeah. Oh, this is the one.
We're gonna add four pages to
the top.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 13. I'd speak to it. It's. It would require. That proof of insurance be shown at time of registering a motor vehicle. A lot of people over the years have asked me why in the world we don't do this, and obviously there are technical reasons why it wasn't originally put in the Mandatory Auto Insurance Act. It's a hassle. Once people show their proof of insurance, they can subsequently cancel it. It's more difficult to register by mail or by the internet. You'd have to come up with a system for doing that. But even after I tell them all those things, they still say we should do it. And this has been going on for a decade because the existing mandatory act was recreated by a law that I authored. And this was a compromise we had made to get it through at the time. It was about 12, 14 years ago. And ever since then, people have been coming up to me and asking, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do this? And I have to explain all those things to them. Why we do it. And they still want to do it. They still think people should do it. So since the sponsor of the bill had suggested that this was something he wasn't absolutely against and was willing to consider this as an amendment, I went ahead and had this amendment drawn up, and just to put the policy proposition before the committee, I do support it. I know it's got some challenges technically, but I think they can be overcome. And you know, many other states do this already. Many states require proof of insurance at time you register. This isn't some radical concept that isn't out there in a lot of parts of America already.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, this bill in its original form actually had this provision in it, but the fiscal note was about 1.8 or 1.9 million, as I recall. And that was the only reason that it was ever removed, because of the cost. It's a very frustrating thing for me. The people of the state of Alaska don't understand why we as legislators can't fix this problem. And when we plead fiscal note, it just goes right over their head. But so it's a level of frustration. I mean, I support this if you want to pass a fiscal note to do the job. I mean, that's this committee's responsibility. I would point out that we do have, I'm working with Senator Donnelly on his other legislation on exempting first offense DUIs now. And that would generate at least $1.3 to $1.5 million of new revenue, in my opinion, to the state to help pay for this. So it's up to the committee.
Senator Donnelly, I was reading a different portion of the bill as you were going through that. Could you explain why this is so expensive?
Well, I think the fiscal note that was on the original bill was based on a little bit different proposal. I think the original bill required notification from the insurance companies if somebody subsequently canceled their insurance. This does not do that. This just requires at the time they register, they show proof of insurance. And I know it's a faulted system because somebody can turn around and cancel after they've once showed their proof of insurance. But it's the smallest next step that we could take, the cheapest next step that I can see to take towards the more expansive version of mandatory auto insurance that a lot of states have, Mr. Chairman. So I think it would be a lot less than the fiscal notes that were under the original bill, because it doesn't require that subsequent notice and all the lot of paperwork that goes with that.
Well, in conference committee, that fiscal note's going to have to go through you, Senator Conway, so I'm not terribly concerned. If you had made provisions to reduce that fiscal note, I'm sure practically that's what's going to happen. So, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that this might work if we had more DMVs throughout the state of Alaska, but people in rural Alaska, 90% of their renewals are mail-ins. How would that be addressed with this bill? I think it would be more cumbersome for them to get their licenses renewed. But I don't think we're going to be adding any more DMVs.
Senator Donnelly?
Mary Washburn's here from DMV, but I would guess a couple of things. First of all, it would be more cumbersome. They would have to get some sort of insurance card or a letter from the insurance company that said they had a policy and put that in the envelope when they mailed it in. So it would be an extra step they'd have to go through, and it might slow it down a bit. I would imagine that with technology the way it is today, with the internet sites, the companies are smart enough to come up with something to deal with that issue too. And of course, most of rural Alaska, not on the road system and below a certain traffic count, is already excluded from the mandatory insurance requirement. So the real remote areas are already exempt from this requirement.
It would be no more cumbersome than what you have to do now if you live in an area like Anchorage or Fairbanks, where you have to have the certification for your IM test.
That's true.
This would be far less, because you're just going to get a notice from your insurance company, whereas this, you have to take with the IM, you have to take your car there, you have to get it inspected. If there are any problems, you have to change them and pay for those costs. So I don't think it would be terribly cumbersome, because you're going to get a notice. They send you a notice with your policy anyway. It's a little card. You could probably even just make a copy of it and send it on to the DMV.
My company sends me two.
Actually, you're right. Senator Green.
Tell me what that be. on page four, one of the things that Senator Donnelly, could you address the last section 24? Page four, line eight.
That section simply requires that the insurance card that we all get from our companies, that people keep it in their vehicle with them. So they would actually have in their possession when they're driving.
And what would happen if you didn't have it?
I imagine it's the same thing. I would have to check exactly. It's just a requirement that they keep the card with them in their car. I don't imagine I think the most it would be is a violation, probably.
Mr. Chairman, and again, I would like to note that, as Senator Donnelly mentioned earlier, proof of insurance is only good for the time you keep it in effect. And you may have your card, and immediately thereafter, cancel that insurance and have a card in your automobile that looks perfectly valid. And it's only going to come to light if you have a chargeable accident. And that is the same sequence of events that it's going to come up now if you were, when we are required to have insurance and choose not to. And I am very much opposed to this, and it's bad policy. And we may say that this has no, we don't know what the physical implications are. They're not as grim as someone else's, but I can guarantee you this will create a physical note for lots of people around the state of Alaska. And I'm more concerned about that than I am about.
Mr. Chairman?
Are you finished, Senator Green?
Okay.
Yeah. Just if you go ahead, Senator Donnelly.
Well, thank you. You know, when we first created mandatory auto insurance, I think in 84, and the bill to get it through, it had a 5-year sunset clause on it. And in 88, we tried to get rid of the sunset clause, and it got blocked in the Senate committee back then, and it actually sunset. And during those 5 years, the compliance, we were down to about almost a single digit uninsured, because there was people, it was a new law, there was a lot of information out there. People went and got the insurance because even though it didn't require proof of insurance up front, they were all thought, oh, this is something I have to do now. And then the law sunsetted, and the uninsured rate more than doubled. It went way up, and because there was headlines, no longer mandatory auto insurance. You don't have to do it anymore, right? And by the time I got the bill through to reinstate mandatory auto insurance, well, we picked up a few percentage points, but we never got back to where we were when the law was first adopted. And even today, we have in the teens is the spread, you know, where we think we've got, from some people estimate high teens of uninsured. And I really believe that just the process of having people actually have to have the insurance would, number one, restore that educational factor we had back when the 84 law first passed, and I think would dramatically impact, you know, that rate we have now, because people would no longer just be able to sign that thing and say they had it. They'd have to actually go through the process of going and getting insurance, and then they're going to have to make the calculated decision, now I'm going to cancel my insurance because I don't want to do it, right? And I really believe that that would get us back down close to where we were when the law first passed. And, you know, if you look at the other states that, like North Carolina, that are just notorious for their major enforcement efforts, I mean, they go around and they pull plates and they do all kinds of dramatic things. They're still in, you know, they've still got a non-compliance rate of 5-7%. So if we can get down to about 10%, I'd be pretty excited about it. And I really believe that this might get us down to about 10%. You're always going to have your people, the intentional abusers. They're going to be able to avoid it. Senator Green's absolutely right about that. Even North Carolina has those people, you know, with the strongest enforcement efforts in the nation. But I really think this step, from both an educational point of view and just as the next step, is going to have a real impact on the uninsured rate.
Just a moment. Senator Olson, Senator Wilkin, and then Senator Ward, and then back to Senator Green.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You know, I like living in a society that's less encumbered by some of these requirements that we're putting on people. And certainly if we had more DMVs out there, it would make things a lot easier. And I see people at this table that have at least as an intensive lifestyle as I do. But when I look at this bill, when I've got proof of insurance, and I've got vehicles in these are private vehicles. I got vehicles in Nome. I got them in Barrow. I got them in Anchorage. I got them down here. It seems, and if I get stopped and I got to show this stuff, you know, there's always that chance that you're not going to have exactly what you need there to show the officer. And he's going to look at you as a criminal. And I don't consider myself necessarily one of those people that are that on that side of the law. So I tend to side with those that are opposed to the amendment.
I think you have a legitimate concern, Senator Olson, but it is somewhat mitigated on the last part of the the amendment, where if you don't have it with you, but you have it.
When driving. Hmm? He's talking about when applying for a license or registration.
I think he said when driving.
Actually, I said when driving, yes.
It's your concerns are somewhat mitigated on the last page there, and may or may not change what you're thinking about it there. It where on line 13, however, person charged, you read that. Senator Wilkins?
Actually, could I just make a comment? But if you go on to line 14, you may not be convicted if the person produces in court. I mean, if I'm not even going to be in town because I was there for overnight, I don't want to have to come back and go to court to prove to myself that I've got proof of insurance.
Well, it says, however, a person charged with violating this section may not be convicted if they produce in court or in the office of the arresting or citing officer proof of the insurance. So you could run it by the police station.
It's another burden I don't want to deal with.
I understand. Senator Wilkins.
Thanks. Two quick comments. I'm fully supportive of the amendment, although I would like to revisit it future time. Section 24, I'm not sure it adds to what we're trying to do. I would remind that when you are involved in an accident, you have to sign an affidavit that you do have insurance. But we'll talk about that later, I hope. I've been involved with my trucks on the road and personally with my family involved in accidents, and invariably it is with an uninsured motorist. So I'm fully supportive of taking this next step, and I'm not so sure a future legislature might want to take another step, regardless of the inconvenience to the consumer, because over and over, the cost of my insurance and your insurance is being driven up because of uninsured motorists in our state. So this is the first step. I'm fully supportive, but I would like to revisit Section 24.
Senator Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will... believe on the face of this, I tend to be supportive of it, but I would just soon not vote on it until we know what it costs. And I don't see anything that is that crucial that we need to do this right now today without finding out the cost of it before we pass it through. If that means we come in and work on Saturday, so be it. This is an important issue. And I do want to know what it costs before we vote on it. I think that's reasonable. And I've heard from a million down, I'd like to have a note on it.
It's significantly less than a million, I think.
Well, whatever it is, I know that in other budgets, I've had to do away with things because of $10,000. And so I do want to know what the cost is.
Mary, do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mary Marshman, I'm the director for the Division of Motor Vehicles. I have a copy of the amendment. Appreciate that, because it wasn't part of the CS. We did not compose a formal fiscal note. A couple of comments. The cost that you're looking at is somewhere between $500,000 and $1.4 million, from what I see in this.
Yeah.
It's not a small. I agree with you. I agree with Senator Donnelly. I think we need to take the next step. Within the division, what we are doing now is monitoring the uninsured rates, attempting to get a handle on the recidivism rates, and looking for a solution that that encompasses all of the segments of our business.
Can I interrupt just for a second?
Sure.
The question was specifically on the cost, and I'll let you go ahead and talk more. But why is this so expensive?
Because DMV is not just DMV, Mr. Chairman. DMV is all of the dealerships who are selling vehicles and issuing vehicle registrations. It's the emission inspection stations. It is the testing facilities. It's all of our business partners, and we have, I think, over 500 of them now throughout the state. It's mail. People have to mail in their registrations. To submit a proof of insurance means that you have to mail something in, and we either have to mail it back or we have to trash it. Or if you don't send in the right thing, we start to set up a correspondence with you, or we deny your registration. It means that for our web and our IVR registration renewals, we don't have the ability to handle this right now through web and IVR. we would either have to discontinue those services, and that would be a real consideration. This is not a scare tactic. We would either have to discontinue those services, or we would have to add a male adjunct to them, or you're talking about significant computer programming to try to funnel insurance agency electronically through the web IVR. What I started to say is that, indeed, DMV is not just DMV. It's not a bunch of offices throughout the state. It's a much bigger organization that involves a significant amount of private enterprise, for which we're delighted, as well as electronic avenues. What we're doing within the division is looking at this problem because we agree with you. We need to go the next step. What we want to do is be able to take a comprehensive approach that will address the electronic venues, that will address our partners. It won't create another step, as a, for instance, when a new car dealer sells a car, instead of being able to issue license plates on the spot, they've got to wait for proof of insurance from the purchaser of the vehicle. We want to be able to tackle all of that in some sort of a comprehensive package rather than being faced, if you will, with a deadline and maybe having to piecemeal it and not doing as good or as comprehensive a job. So I agree with you. I think we need to go there. I would like to take a step back from amending this bill at this point in time, allow the division to continue the work that it's doing and come to the legislature with a comprehensive approach.
Senator Donnelly.
Mary, what about putting like an effective date on this that's maybe the end of 2003? You know, I mean, you know, so that January 1, 2004, this would go into effect. That would drive the agency towards developing a comprehensive plan, and it wouldn't incur any costs this fiscal year or even next, you know, right away, but would be a clear message that we want to get a plan together, and then we could come back in and fine-tune it. But it's been delayed for so long because there's been no, you know how things tend to get done because there's a date, right? Mm-hmm. And if we set a date far enough in the future, I would be happy with that, Mr. Chairman, to give the agencies the time to say, hey, we got to get together now, we got to work on this thing and come up with, you know, and then they could come back and fine tune it in the next legislature. I'd be happy with that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, I understand where you're going, and yes, there's merit to that. My preference is that we don't set a date. I would, because this does involve language, specific legislation, I would like as a part of the package to examine quite practically how we're going to meet all of these components of the agency. I'd like to look at the language that would go with it. As a, for instance, one perhaps rural Alaska might have a different method than a dealership, a home station, than an urban office. I really want to look at the entire scope and see, it's not going to be an inexpensive proposition, and in my mind, if it's going to be done, it ought to be done right. And I think we can better do that in another way. But I agree with you, and you know, I will make the commitment that this is a place that the division is going. It is a place the division is going within the next couple of years. It will take work. I will work with you on it.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Donnelly.
I guess if there's no other questions, Mary, I'd go ahead and propose a delayed effective date for this as an amendment to the amendment of January 1st, 2004.
To the amendment only?
Yeah, it's an amendment to the amendment. Just the effective date of the provisions requiring proof of insurance would go into effect 2004.
Senator Ward.
And I hate to be like this, but I just heard that it costs between $500,000 and $1.5 million. Could we somehow narrow that down a little bit before we pass this out? I mean, this, you know, we just spent hours arguing about $10,000 in a subcommittee,
I would like to know a little closer what we're talking about. And I don't disagree. I mean, none of us like people driving around without insurance, and we'd like it fixed. But I would like to know what the cost is.
Senator Osterman?
I'm having some of the same problems. It's very difficult, having gone through the process we've just gone through with finance subcommittees, to say that we're going to take $700,000 out of a program and eliminate what we're doing for management of our resources. But at the same point in time, so that we can have a card in our vehicle that says that we have insurance, we're going to spend $1.5 or whatever $1 million we're going to spend to have that card in our car, versus trying to protect our resources over here. I'm having a very difficult time in my mind even justifying voting for this whole bill at this point in time. I just ran the numbers on some of these fiscal notes here, and I'm already over $600,000 if I read them correctly. But now we're going to add another $500 to a $1.5 million.
It's two different versions. Those fiscal notes are two different versions. Yeah, the fiscal notes are to a different version. It's those don't reflect at all. No. Senator Wilkin.
Senator Donnelly, would you consider a friendly amendment that you insert a requirement for the department to come to the next legislative session with a progress report, say April 1 of 02?
Okay.
03. Excuse me, 03.
Yeah, I'd probably even go a little earlier than that, so the next legislative session would be guaranteed the opportunity to, they could go in and they could repeal this if it just proved unworkable. They could modify it in a lot of different ways. That's why I tried to set it far enough in the future so that there'd be plenty of time for the legislature to, the next legislature to do something if they wanted to.
I think that, I think what you want to do is appropriate, and I think there's a need to do it. But the more I think about it, what we have in this amendment is a fairly expensive bill. And I don't know that it needs to be attached to HB4. I think we should, let's crank out a committee bill and have it up next week. And we'll do it that way. It's going to take a little longer, but I think we'll have more information. I intend to vote no on it, not because I don't like it. I do like it. I just, attaching it to HB4, I think, it may not be the best thing right now.
I just have one comment.
Senator Green?
Do you really mean proof means a copy of the insurance policy? Because I don't think you want a copy of the insurance policy in every vehicle that a person owns. Because isn't it the auto insurance? It's several pages folded in little packets. I got to tell you, this gets very expensive for the consumer, because we are the ones that are going to pay for every one of those packets that's going to come to us to stick in our car.
Well, it says there's an option for or written or electronic certification. So the written certification can be just the card that we